Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Art House Garage podcast, the snob-free film community where we make art house, classic, and indie cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today I couldn't be more excited because not only are we going to talk about last week's Oscars, but we are starting something entirely new. If our mission at Art House Garage is to explore classic art house and indie movies, then why not dig into each of those areas one at a time? So that's exactly what we're doing. Today's episode is part one of a six-film series on classic cinema. We are going to take a look at six titles, digging into each of them with the help of a very special guest, film writer and classic cinema expert, Rance Collins. He actually joined me to talk about the Oscars last time, and now he's back for the next six episodes. Why are we doing this? People who love classic movies really love them, but for the rest of us, it can be hard to break in. If I want to learn more about some classics, where do I start? It can be overwhelming because there are just so many movies out there. Well, to help you out, we have chosen six titles that can act as gateway movies. If you have never seen a movie older than 1990, that's okay. These movies are a great place to start. Here are the titles we'll be looking at. It Happened One Night, Casablanca, All About Eve, Double Indemnity, The Best Years of Our Lives, and Citizen Kane. There will also be some other movies discussed. I'm planning to talk about some upcoming Arkansas film events in the coming weeks as well, and I may also squeeze in a few discussions of 2020 movies, so keep an eye on your podcast feed for those. But let's go ahead and get into today's movie. It Happened One Night is a romantic comedy from 1934, directed by Frank Capra and starring Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. It's hilarious, it feels modern, and it contains many iconic moments that have been the inspiration for countless films since. The basic story is this. A wealthy heiress, aka a spoiled rich girl, runs away from home and meets a down-on-his-luck reporter. He finds a great story to report. She meets a man who doesn't want to control her, and eventually the sparks fly. That's all you need to know for now. Rance and I give more context in the discussion, and we keep it spoiler-free. After the movie talk, we switch over to the Oscars and break down our favorite moments from the big ceremony earlier this month. All right, let's get into it. Here is my discussion with Rance Collins about the classic film, It Happened One Night.
Hey, wait for the king. Hey, wait for the king.
Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses.
Dugging's an art. Don't let it soak so long. A dip and frock in your mouth.
If you notice, the coat came first, then the tie, then the shirt.
I'm going to be a few minutes late. Be sure to wait for me.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Would you believe it? This is the first time I've ever been alone with a man.
Yeah?
It's a wonder I'm not panic-stricken. There's a brain behind that face of yours, isn't there?
Welcome back to Art House Garage, Rance Collins.
Hey.
Thanks for being back. I'm so excited to dive into some classic movies with you over the next little bit of the podcast. And we are starting with a really good one called It Happened One Night. You are very well acquainted with this movie, from what I understand.
This is actually, if you want a little background on how I came to this movie, this was something that my mom introduced to me because my mom kind of grew up, you know, I guess like so many people, they're like not caring about movies that happened before their lifetime. You know, keep in mind, this is in the, you know, 60s and 70s for my mother. But they had a screening of this movie at Baylor University, where she went to college, and she went and just like completely fell in love with classic film because of this film.
Wow.
And then when I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old, we had it on DVD, and she introduced it to me.
Wow.
And then I proceeded to often introduce that to friends of mine. And I've probably seen it. I've seen it on the big screen as well.
Nice.
Because I've gone to a screening that they had here in LA. So I've probably seen it, I don't know, 8 or 9 times at this point.
So this is a good gateway movie into classic movies, which is part of the point of doing this podcast series, is that if you're someone who's always kind of wanted to get it more into classic movies, but you're intimidated, don't really know where to start, we're going to try to do six of the kind of the best ones. And this is, I think, a really good start. I first saw this actually in high school. We had a little film club that one of our English teachers did, and she showed this, and I was like just kind of blown away by how funny it is. And in high school especially, I was like, okay, this came out in 1934. I had no idea what to expect. Like, what were people even like then? But it's so, it feels modern in some ways. It's really, the banter feels like something you'd hear in a movie that was made last week, you know? I really enjoyed it, and I loved revisiting it. But
isn't it funny how you look back, like people, we always feel like we're the first people to have certain thoughts and certain ideas, and the first people to discover sex and, you know, all this other stuff. And you look back at these films and you see like, oh, like these emotions, these ideas have always exist in every generation with every group of people. We just feel like we're the first because we're the ones experiencing it right now.
Yeah, I think it's my favorite way to experience history at all is in the movies. And it's kind of the reason I love watching stuff that's either older or from a very different culture or just from a different context than, you know, the Marvel movies that we're seeing all the time in the theater. It kind of gives you a really different context, but and you see all the cultural differences from now to 1934 or for even a modern movie that came out in a different country. But you also see the commonalities. You see what's the same despite all these cultural or time barriers. And anyway, so I definitely had very much that experience watching this, and recommend it to everyone. So a little bit more about the movie. It stars Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, and directed by Frank Capra.
The legend.
Legendary. So if you're not familiar with classic film at all, you may have heard his name. He's a really big deal. Made some of the best movies ever back then. Yes. And this movie won a ton of Oscars, right? All the major ones.
This is the first of three films to win what are considered to be the top five awards. Picture, director, actor, actress, and screenplay. And the other two, in case you're wondering, are One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Silence of the Lambs. And that means like another movie doesn't do it for over 40 years after this film is released. Yeah. So it's a very rare occurrence. Quite and it's been legacy. You know, 30 years since it's happened. So it's rare for that to happen. And it's interesting that this is a movie that did it, because within a few years, the Academy is not as warm on comedies.
Still to this day.
So it's interesting. Yeah, still to this day. Like, you don't see, I mean, the next like out and out comedy to win Best Picture, it's probably not until Annie Hall, you know. I may be skipping over something, but if there is comedy, it's something like An American in Paris, where it's also a musical, or you know.
So this movie is also a pre-code movie, which another will kind of define some of these terms loosely if you're new to classic movies. But pre-code means it came out before basically the decency laws were enforced, right? Is that a kind of a good way to sum that up?
The pre-code period, when people say pre-code, they're usually specifically referring to a period between 1930 and 1934. In 1930, there was a suggested set of guidelines that were written by what would become known as the Hays Code. These are the things we don't want in movies, and that was a response to the fact that there were all these, I mean, like, silent movies is a whole different ball game. There is a lot more open sexuality, lot more open. Adultery is a huge theme that is kind of goes unchecked, and violence. It's you see a lot, and nudity even, you see a lot more of that in earlier films. And there was this perception that Hollywood was this place of decadence, and that was causing state censorship boards to censor movies on their own and withdraw movies from circulation within those states. And so in order to keep their businesses alive, to keep their films in circulation, the studios created their own set of guidelines to adhere by, because there was also a risk of the fact of the federal government working coming in at that point.
And they're trying to
So 1930, this set of rules is established, but for the most part, studios don't take it seriously, and they're working in defiance of that. And it isn't until 1934 that you basically have to be passed by the Hays Commission in order to be released into theaters. And It Happened One Night came out just a month or two before that officially went into effect. The movie itself is, I mean, like, this is not a movie that would have raised any eyebrows and would have been the cause of the Hays Code. There are probably a couple of little things that might have been, like, you know, the ending is a little suggestive. Because there's this whole situation with the walls of Jericho breaking down and,
which is a great tooting a trumpet. Yes, it's
pretty subtle, and it might have gotten through after 1934. I'm not sure, but the movies that this is more discussing are, like, there's a film from 1933 called Babyface, which stars Barbara Stanwyck, and it literally, I'm not joking, shows her sleeping her way up a company ladder, and in each scene she's on a different floor of this high-rise building in New York. And in the first scene, she finds the boss of that floor, she sleeps with them, gets a promotion. It's like the first 45 minutes of the movie is just watching her sleep her way up the ladder, and you see that, and it's shocking. So it was that type of thing that got the Hays Code. I mean, there's also examples of movies that have brief nudity. There's examples of movies that have some profanity, and it's also tame and mild compared to, you know, an average film today. But at the time, Depression era audiences, it was a different time in our history. But if you see those movies, you do see that we didn't invent anything.
It's such an interesting thing, because I think I know a lot of people do this too, just have a maybe a bias towards classic movies that they're going to be boring or not edgy or you know, squeaky clean in some way, and that's just not the case, especially in this era. But even this, which again is not raising any huge red flags for that sort of thing, it is pretty suggestive in some places. And as knowing it was pre-code, I was watching and kind of trying to see what are the most edgy parts of this. And there's several kind of suggestive jokes too, I think, more than things that you see. But
the biggest thing that this movie had, the biggest impact this movie has on culture, is it sets the prototype for every romantic comedy that comes after it. A lot of people also call it the first screwball comedy. I don't know if it's actually the first one, because there are a couple of movies that predate it that are of the screwball variety, but the screwball comedies are known for kind of mocking upper class, and showing upper class people to be ridiculous. And this really caught fire during the Depression, when there was such a discrepancy between the upper and lower classes. And so movies like My Man Godfrey, which is, which owes something to It Happened One Night, became very, very popular. And It Happened One Night's kind of the first of those movies. It definitely is, it definitely does show some decadence of the rich. And what it really does, and this is the thing that I think is most interesting about the movie, is it takes place in, it was filmed in, takes place in 1934, and you see the impact of the Depression all throughout the film. And when they're riding on the bus, and there's a woman who doesn't have any money and has nothing. She passes out on the bus, and you see the impact that this is having in the country, while we're also at the same time seeing what a huge deal the nation is making out of this super rich, spoiled heiress who's in every single newspaper. And that's saying something about what's going on in the country at the time.
Yeah, that's another thing.
And showing how ridiculous it is.
Really modern. You know, it's they didn't have social media, but it almost felt like that sort of making a big deal out of this one story and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it's just interesting that 2019, so many years later, not so far away from being 100 years old, this movie. And yet our Best Picture and many of our Oscar nominees are about wealth inequality. So it just...
2020, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 2020. Yeah, so just showing... yeah, I keep forgetting the year has changed. But
I know.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. It feels
like... I know.
That's another fascinating thing about watching older movies like this. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting one.
Actually, so you mentioned that it had a huge effect on romantic comedies, and you can definitely feel that. It also was influential. I was reading a few things, so this had some impact on like Bugs Bunny, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. There is probably the best scene and the most famous scene in the film. If you know anything about the movie, this is probably the scene that you know. The hitchhiking
scene. Oh yeah, I've seen it parodied so many times and other things, and this is what it's from. It's amazing.
This is what it's from. Did we give a plot rundown? I forget if
no
we
let's do that. Yeah,
so basically there is this rich heiress played by Claudia Colbert, whose father does not approve of the man that she wants to marry, and he's going to try to prevent her from doing so, but she ends up literally jumping off their yacht and swimming to shore, and then she goes incognito and tries to basically take a bus up to New York, where her fiance is. And so she's going from from South Florida up to New York and taking a bus the whole way. She ends up meeting this guy whose name is Peter Warren. I don't know why I remember his name. Her name is
Elizabeth Andrews, I believe. Let me double
Andrews, check. Yes, Ellie. She ends up meeting him on a bus, and he's basically a down-on-his-luck reporter who really needs a good story. And so he strikes a deal with her where if she gives him the big exclusive story, he will take her the whole way.
Yeah.
'Cause she doesn't actually have any cash on hand, and she needs help getting there. So they end up, of course, hating each other at the beginning, and then all that turns into sexual tension, and they have to share a motel room a couple of times, and she's super nervous about that because I don't think she's actually ever been alone with a man in her life.
Yeah, she says that at one point. Like, this is the first time I've ever been alone with a man. Yeah.
And so they end up, there's this incredibly adorable scene where he puts up a string and puts a blanket over it and calls it the walls of Jericho, separating their two beds,
dividing the room.
And then at one point, you know, they can't take the bus anymore for whatever reason, and so they start hitchhiking, and he it tells her about how he's the expert on hitchhiking and shows her all the different ways that you can use your thumb to try to hitch a ride. And of course, nothing he does works. And then she lifts up her skirt and shows her leg, and somebody immediately stops. No. But during this scene, before they start hitchhiking, he is eating a carrot, and he is munching on that carrot. And the way that he's munching on it and the way that he is talking ends up being the inspiration for Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, it's such a dead on
carrot and what's a dog.
It's such a dead on thing that I really thought of it, not even knowing that. Funny enough, like the way the carrot looked was just like the Bugs Bunny classic carrot. It's got like the dangling piece on it. You can see it's immediately iconic.
And the movie is full of little moments like that that have that. I feel like classic films, the moments from classic films that become iconic, get referenced in so many later works that when you end up watching them, there's something about it that feels familiar. Like before I saw Singing in the Rain, I had seen Gene Kelly on that lamppost a million times. So when you finally get to that moment in the movie, there's a bit of magic that hits you as you're watching it. And I feel like It Happened One Night has a lot of those moments. And it's just because the movies that came after it, the When Harry Met Sally's and the Runaway Brides and the Pretty Women followed. I mean, in one way or another, they're all referencing this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely thought of that. I thought of Runaway Bride specifically, actually.
It has a lot in common with Runaway Bride.
I don't know if we should avoid spoilers. I know it's a very old movie, but vaguely, what happens towards the end, it's coming to a head. She's about to be back with her fiance, and they both are grumpy because they obviously are in love with each other and don't want to go through with this, but they're afraid to say it. And then, it goes to the very last minute, as you would expect. And
my favorite line happens toward the end of the movie. Peter Warren is talking to her father, because they end up having some type of fight, and she's just deciding like she's going to go ahead and marry the guy, even though she's in love with Peter Warren. I can't think of the name of the actor who plays the father, but he's in a bunch of movies. He's
Walter
like a
Connolly.
Really Walter Connolly. Yes. If you watch very many old movies, you'll see his face a lot. He's one of those character
he's
actors.
Very
he's
funny.
Everything.
And his character surprised me a little bit because you think he's just going to be the overbearing father and
a douche.
He ends up being more than that towards the end and being really key to the movie's ending. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. And he ends up repeatedly asking an increasingly agitated Clark Gable if he loves Claudette Colbert. And he keeps asking, and every time Clark Gable's like, I wouldn't marry her if she was the last woman on earth. Da, 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 da. And then finally he's like, but do you love her? And he says, yes, but don't hold it against me. I'm a little screwy myself. I love that.
Yeah, so good. It's such a genuinely funny movie throughout. I think that's one of the reasons it's so good is that Clark Gable, as this kind of fast-talking, kind of like Bugs Bunny, kind of a BS artist. Like, he has all these different methods of hitchhiking, and he talks about, there's a long thing about riding piggyback and the proper way to do that, and it's so silly and so funny. and their
it
chemistry
is
really good.
He's very charming.
Yeah.
He's very modern. He's very charming. And she also, in spite of the fact that she looks so much like a 1930s woman with the pencil eyebrows and the and her, the way that she does her makeup and her hair, it feels very 1930s. She has a very, very natural delivery that I don't think a lot of people associate with the time period.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the surprising things. She's almost like a quirky, cutesy, funny. I mean, I was thinking of like Zooey Deschanel owes a lot to her with her like New Girl persona.
Yeah.
Like those kind of modern things. You can see a lot of influence from this too.
I love during the hitchhiking scene, there's a moment where Clark Gable is showing the three different types of ways that you can thumb a ride. Mm-hmm. And he explains one and then he does it. And it's like a long, like thumb gesture. And she's just perched up like on this fence post behind him. And she just goes, "Oh, that's amazing."
Or yeah, she does
like that.
And
she does it in such,
she
does it
so
sarcastically. Exactly. And it's just like, it's so subtle, but so funny. And she's full of lots of moments like that. And apparently they didn't even really like each other and neither one wanted to make a movie, which is the funny part about it.
Wow.
They did it. Like, she didn't want to make it because making this movie postponed a vacation she was supposed to be on. So she just like was every single day, like, let's shoot a little bit more. We could do another scene.
Wow.
Cause she just wanted to get through it as fast as possible. And Clark Gable, this was a movie produced by Columbia Pictures, and Clark Gable was under contract to MGM, and MGM was considered the top of the top studios. And him being loaned out to Columbia for this movie was like a punishment for him.
Wow.
Like, so Louis Mayer was trying to punish him for, I don't know, like some transgression, something he had done over at MGM that the big boss didn't approve of. Maybe he had refused a movie to do a movie that he wanted to do or something. And so his punishment was to go over and make a movie at dingy little Columbia Studios. And this ends up being one of the biggest hits of the year. And it wins him an Oscar.
That's such a great Hollywood story, you know?
Yeah. Wow. And and the year of the Oscars, this came out 1934, was also the same year that an actress named Betty Davis really hit hard. She made a movie called Of Human Bondage, and there was a huge controversy because there were only three Best Actress nominees at the time, and she wasn't one of them. Mm. And it had been like the breakout performance of the year. And so there ended up being this huge write-in campaign to get her on the ballot. And they ended up opening the nominations that year to write-in nominees. And that was banned after a couple of years. Only one Oscar was ever awarded off of a write-in campaign. And that's the following year for Best Cinematography for Midsummer's Night's Dream, in case you're wondering. It was not nominated. It was a write-in vote. But because of that write-in vote, Claudette Colbert thought she didn't have a chance of winning.
Wow.
Because there was all this fever surrounding Betty Davis not being nominated. Yeah. And so she didn't bother to show up for the ceremony. In fact, she was about to get on a train to go on a trip that night. And so when word got out, because at that point in time, the winners were actually revealed to the LA Times a few hours before the ceremony, because they wanted them to have the results in the evening edition. Yeah. And so technically it was happening before the ceremony, but people could find out if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. The sealed envelope wasn't revealed and didn't start until 1940. Mm-hmm. So word got that she was going to win. And so Columbia sent a guy to Union Station here in LA.
You should go.
And grabbed her. And so if you see the pictures of her accepting the Oscar, she's in like a travel suit, basically.
Wow. That sounds like the plot of the movie.
In a little tiny Shirley Temple.
We got to track her down.
I know. The outfit she's wearing looks like the outfit she wears in the film, actually. Oh, and Shirley Temple, tiny, tiny little Shirley Temple, is the one who presents her the Oscar.
Gosh, that's so cute. So I'll have to find that video and put on the show notes. That sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is, I'm vaguely familiar with Clark Gable, but I haven't actually seen Claudette Colbert in anything else besides this the last time I saw it many years ago. But she's really a great screen presence. And I don't know, it's so interesting. Like, definitely, like, the beauty has changed over the years, but you can absolutely see why she's a bombshell, quote unquote, in this movie. She's there's many, many shots of her just looking stunningly beautiful. And then Clark Gable is just electric as well.
Quite
on the
a
screen.
Presence.
Yeah.
If you end up being piqued about, if you watch this movie and you're like, oh my gosh, Claudette Colbert, like, what else did she do? Because ultimately, like, going a gateway into classic film, part of it is you watch a movie and then you want to see more movies with those people or with that director.
And the stars were such a big deal in old Hollywood that it kind of makes sense to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, not necessarily every movie they make is as good as It Happened One Night, but, you know, their presence and their personality is seen in so many other movies. Claudette Colbert, first of all, please look at pictures of her through the years, because nobody aged better than she did.
Wow.
In the days before the ways that people age now, in Hollywood, I when you have cheekbones like that, I guess, she did not like to be photographed from her right side. So you'll notice that, every shot of her, her left side is usually favored. Cause she thought her cheekbones were like, one was higher than the other, and I don't know, something. But she's in a lot of really great movies in the 30s and 40s. She's in another movie with Clark Gable called Boomtown that also has Spencer Tracy and Hedy Lamarr. She's in a comedy with Jimmy Stewart that's ironically called It's a Wonderful World. Very similar title.
Yeah.
She's in a World War II home front epic that was nominated for Best Picture, and she was nominated for Best Actress called Since You Went Away, that also has a Shirley Temple playing her teenage daughter.
Oh, wow.
And it's also the movie where David Selznick, who produced Gone with the Wind and some other movies, he produced this movie and he casted and began a love affair with Jennifer Jones, who becomes his wife, and that becomes his obsession for the remainder of his life, and he only produces movies with her, and that is to the detriment of both of them. It also is really awkward because her husband at the time is in that movie. His name is Robert Walker, and he is probably most famous for playing the bad guy in Strangers on a Train. Their marriage is falling apart while they're playing lovers in this movie, and it's with the guy who produced the movie. It's like a whole, anyway, it's beside the point. Since You Went Away,
all the drama
is another, all the drama is so fascinating. So interesting. Since You Went Away is another, I think there's one called, is it Three Came Back or Three Came Home, or there's another World War II movie she's
home,
in.
Yeah.
Three Came Home. So she's in a lot of movies in the 30s and 40s. Bluebeard's Eight Wife is another screwball that she's in. With Gary Cooper. It's just like, she's just one of those who, even when the movie is not very good, you know you're going to have a good time because she's in it. And Clark Gable obviously probably has a filmography that people are more familiar with. Of course, he was in the biggest moneymaker of all time, Gone with the Wind. He was quite legitimately the king of Hollywood up until the moment he died, because he died relatively young, in 1961. His last movie was one that people have heard of because Marilyn Monroe's in it, The Misfits. You know, and he was with MGM for most of the time, and he served in World War II, and he just made, you know, hit after hit after hit in the 30s and 40s. Red Dust is one of the 30s that's pretty good, and San Francisco, which is has like the best 1906 San Francisco earthquake effects that you'll ever see in your life.
Oh, wow.
So he's a good one to fall for, because there's so much material, high quality material with him in it. Frank Capra, the year before this movie was made, Frank Lloyd is the name of the director. He did a movie called Cavalcade, which is a very not well-known Best Picture from 1933. The year before It Happened One Night came out, that movie won Best Picture and Best Director. Frank Capra was also up for a movie that year, and the person who presented the award just said, "Come on up, Frank," and Frank Capra. Frank Capra started to go accept the award, and it was Frank Lloyd, not Frank Capra.
Wow.
So super awkward. But Frank Capra ended up, he has won the second most Oscars of any director ever. He's one of a couple directors, actually, that have won three. William Wyler is another one.
Who's number one?
Number one is John Ford. John Ford.
Westerns.
Won... Yeah, a lot of Westerns. He won for The Informer, How Green Is My Valley, The Quiet Man, and The Grapes of Wrath. The Grapes of Wrath. Stagecoach came out in the Gone with the Wind year, so that wasn't happening.
No chance.
It's really a shame. 1939 is a really great movie year, but like, it's like, and at the very end, in December of 1939, is when Gone with the Wind came out, and it literally
obliterated everything else.
Obliterated everything, and nobody else had a chance. But and if Mr. Smith Goes to Washington had come out any other year, Frank Capra would have four Oscars. Frank Capra would win again for You Can't Take It With You, which came out in 1938, and he won his third Oscar for I don't know if I actually know this offhand. I know I do.
Let's see.
You've got to help me.
We've got Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. He won for that.
Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. That's right, because it it was a year where the Best Picture wasn't the Best Director winner. Hmm. So Mr. Deeds, which a lot of people know the remake with Adam Sandler, yeah. Mr. Deeds is another great, like, heartwarming film. Gary Cooper, once again, he made Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is still shows how very relevant corruption and politics has always been.
One of the best political movies ever.
Ever, period, yeah. And most importantly, he made what I would argue is probably one of the 10 best movies of all time. It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Which so clearly holds up. And so, most, and I feel like that's the one that people know. But Capper is known for having a quasi-sentimental quality to his films. Mm-hmm. Although the thing that I and they call it Capricorn, but I think that it's like in his best work, like It Happened One Night, like It's a Wonderful Life, he has this kind of dark edge to sentimental topics. Because It Happened One Night is a romantic comedy, but it has this undercurrent of, like, the poverty of the nation is right there the whole time. And It's a Wonderful Life has the most, you could, out of context, it has the most saccharine ending that you could possibly imagine. But it happens after you have to go through the ringer with somebody who is about to kill themselves. It's he's a person who understands you have to earn laugh or a tear or a, you know, he's honestly one of the best. I mean, like, people owe so much to Frank Capra because he taught us. He's one of the, I would say that in Hollywood, in a time where producers often mattered more than directors, in a time where there were not many auteurs, Frank Capra was one of the first directors who really had a stamp on his films where you could say that's a Capra picture.
And yet they're pretty diverse. Like, you have the best Christmas movie of all time, probably. One of the best romantic comedies ever made. One of the best political movies ever made. Yeah, it's interesting that in so many different spots, it's such a huge legacy for so many.
But you see the thread between them. And it's interesting for me to compare him with somebody like somebody that we'll be talking about a little bit later on in this series is William Wyler, who is actually my favorite director of all time. He also made a great diverse canon of films, but he has less, you would still probably call him an auteur because he had so much control over the movies he made, but he has less of a distinctive stamp because he just dabbled in so many such starkly different genres, because he's the director who gave us Roman Holiday. He's also the director who gave us Funny Girl. And he's the director who gave us The Best Years of Our Lives, which is a movie we'll be talking about before long. And so he would do war movies, and he would do musicals, and he would do romantic comedies.
And
it's just like nothing...
Yeah.
And he did Ben-Hur. That's the one I was trying to think of. Ben-Hur. And, like, who would ever have thought the director of Ben-Hur did Funny Girl, did Roman Holiday? Like, I mean, none of those seem to have anything to do with each other, but they're all perfect examples of what they are. You know?
Fascinating.
Anyway, no, that's not Frank Capra, but...
Well, more on him later, as Rance mentioned, and I'll also put the list of movies that we're going to discuss on the website, so you can be preparing if you would like to, and watching ahead. Great. Well, any more thoughts on It Happened One Night before we wrap up and get to a little bit of Oscar talk?
You just watch it. It's one of the best movies of all time. It is. It's in the AFI Top 100. It's on the National Film Registry. There's really no reason you shouldn't be watching this movie.
Completely agree. Having seen it twice now, and just I fell in love with it again, watching it again recently. And it feels, as we mentioned, it feels so modern. So don't be afraid of that aspect of it, because it really, I think it'll capture your attention. Even if you're not used to watching things that are black and white or things that are older, this is a great movie and a great place to start if you're trying to get into that.
It gets off the ground running too. Like, you don't have to wait for anything to happen.
Almost shockingly, it's like, oh, we're going. Here we go. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't waste any time in getting into the plot. So,
And
from the second the two main stars are together on screen, the sparks and chemistry are immediately obvious. Yeah. So it's I don't think they ever kiss in the movie either.
Yeah, that's true. There's moments that, so like the raciest thing in it is probably there are moments of undressing, but it's like they're just putting on their pajamas for the night. But I was like, oh, wow, 1934, look at you.
Oh,
here's a woman in her slip, you know.
I forgot about that tidbit. Clark Gable is responsible for undershirts becoming unpopular.
Really?
This movie has Clark Gable changing clothes. He takes off his shirt and he is not wearing an undershirt. And reportedly, undershirt sales plummeted after the release of it happened one
night. Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
There you go.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I'm just thinking he doesn't have. It's just there's Clark Gable. Once he unbuttons.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. The good of places to wrap up this discussion. So, yes, go out and rent it. It's available online, of course. I got it at the library. Got to love the library. They've got everything for free. Mm-hmm. Go and see It Happened One Night. And with that, we're going to transition into a little bit of Oscar reaction. So perfect that you were here, Rance, for Oscar discussion before it happened. And now we can give just a few minutes worth of thoughts about how it all went down. And it was pretty shocking, I have to say. I was certainly surprised
by
the big winner. Yeah, in a great way, for sure. Let me pull up the winner list just so I have it in front of me. But so if you didn't watch, Parasite won everything that we no one was expecting that. At least I was not expecting
four,
it to get.
It won four, right?
Yes, yeah. It didn't actually win everything, but it won four of the biggest awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Foreign Language Film.
International film. It's now called.
They've renamed it.
Yeah.
Which go ahead.
Nearly everything else. I will say nearly every other award print went pretty much as expected.
Yeah.
There weren't that many surprises tonight. The acting awards were boring. I don't mean to be, I'm not saying I'm not like how great for the people who won, but I love the fact that Laura Dern has an Oscar now.
Yes.
And her speech was very touching because her mom was right there and, you know,
she had one of the best speeches I think of the night.
Yeah, and Joaquin Phoenix definitely has improved his speechifying over
still was a little rambly, Zellweger, but it was good in the end. Yeah, go ahead.
Renee Zellweger seemed a little out of sorts. Like, I think I got the point she was trying to make, and it was a really nice point, but I think that she was definitely nervous.
Yeah.
Because
all over the place.
Because which I wondered about, because, like, I mean, she knew she was going to be up there, so I mean,
yeah. you it's know, not and surprised it makes, to anyone.
There was no speech this year like Olivia Colman's last year, which is what I missed.
Yeah.
Because Olivia Colman's incredibly shocked, I didn't expect to be here speech is the kind of thing that is the kind of Oscar moment that I live for. But Parasite winning is so huge in terms of representation, in terms because more so than maybe any other race in film, there are Asian representation is very poor in movies. And this was not a movie. This wasn't an American movie with Asians in it.
Yeah.
Even though one of the biggest hits of last year was a movie, American film with Asians, with Asian actors, Crazy Rich Asians. But it is so huge for, I think also, like, you don't, it's like this segment of people that we ignore in terms of, not only here in the States and the movies that we make, but also when you talk about international cinema, the only thing from Asian culture that anyone seems to know anything about is anime. And you never see imports doing well in art house cinemas that are Asian films, you know. And there are very few.
European films have had that market cornered, like the foreign market in America for a long time. But
Which are movies with white people, you know. To put it bluntly, it is so huge that this movie hit and that so many people watched it and saw, once again, that commonality between cultures. And how when you get over the very small hurdle of 2-inch subtitles, you find yourself getting lost in the story and viewing these people as basically no different than you. And a good story and a well-told movie transcends any language and any racial barrier. And I love that that is a message that is coming out of the Oscars this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Parasite, it's a really good movie.
It is. You know, so many people have said, and I think I agree, it feels like the best movie actually won, which doesn't always happen. And actually seems rare sometimes. Whatever you think about all these movies, I think this one is incredibly strong. It seemed like so many people were saying 1917 was going to be the favorite to win. It's got all the Oscar-y things, the war drama and all of that. So when they announced Parasite, I literally gasped very loud. I was scared my wife was like,
everyone was so excited. You could tell.
Yeah.
The audience wanted it. That's what, I mean, like, I love that it had that support, and I hope that means that, that more international films will be able to break out of the international film category. And that we might be able to see some box office, some mainstream success here in the States for movies like that one in the future.
Absolutely.
At least people might be open to it.
Yeah. I hope so.
And as far as the awards itself, the show.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Yeah.
That it is. We have got to get a host. I'm sorry. I think last year it was a novelty and it kind of worked because of the novel aspect of it. But this year, I think that like there was a lot of really awkward moments where somebody was introducing somebody who was going to introduce something.
introductions.
That's where you have that funny host. You know, that's where you have that Billy Crystal or Whoopi Goldberg who is able to. I mean, like people, you need like a good stand-up comic who can create funny bits, but also be right there, quick on their feet for any type of interesting moment that's going to happen, and find the jokes in the night and keep it moving, and have the biggest thing that the night lacked was cohesion.
A little sloppy somehow or messy.
Has anyone figured out why I really enjoyed the song, but why did Eminem sing?
That's so surprising. They were showing that montage.
It's like, wow, one of the great songs.
I was like, there's a lot of Eminem in this montage. That's weird. Why are they showing us so much Eminem? Gosh, is Eminem here?
And they kept it a secret, you know, which I mean, them keeping it a secret, I mean, like, it was kind of obvious because the camera work was all over the place, but it's like the producers didn't know what to cut to. They didn't explain why we were having, like, they do those types of tributes sometimes, like, let's do a tribute to film. Like, that's not unusual. That has happened before, but why of all things?
I don't know. It was so bizarre.
The movie was, it's been 18 years since the movie came out. That's not a significant anniversary. I really, like, there was the year that Gaga did that Sound of Music melody, if you remember. And they explained it was the 50th anniversary of the movie, and it's an incredibly popular film. Like, it makes, and like, okay, this makes sense. But why? I'm so confused. But I was also like enjoying it because it's a good song.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how. I had so many feelings.
And the audience reactions were so funny too. That was maybe my favorite part, was like watching people reacting in different ways in the crowd.
Like Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
Billie Eilish had some interesting reactions the entire night. Like, yeah, I don't know if she knew where she was.
What did you think of her song, by the way?
She was good. I am a big In Memoriam critic because I like old people so much. I really like this year's the Emmys had a really good In Memoriam this last year. And TCM, if you ever watch Turner Classic Movies, they always have a great one every single year, that they release in December. But both those work in movie clips and quotes. And I prefer In Memoriams that maybe go without using a song, an artist in a song that has words, and instead using like,
I love it when audio, they use like,
like using like the theme from Out of Africa or something. And then you, you get in a few quotes and that kind of thing. I also feel like Doris Day was the biggest female star of her day. I think she should have been right at the end with Kirk Douglas. I would have liked to have seen her. She retired and she didn't have the last, she didn't stay active as long as Kirk Douglas did. But she was like the number one female box office star for 6 years. I mean, that shouldn't have been just shuffled into the middle. That should have been right at the end, you know? And when someone's singing also, I think people are confused about whether or not they can clap for people.
Yeah. Because they clap at the end and I was like, what should we? Yeah.
Suddenly clapping is happening, but there were lots of people that I'm sure the people in the audience knew who they were. Like why, why did the clap? It was just like, it was just very, it's awkward. Mm-hmm. And so I think as beautiful as the song Yesterday is, I would have preferred to have had an instrumental and some movie clips and some quotes. And really, if you want to see what a great In Memoriam looks like, go right in TCM Remembers 2019. And that is what the Oscars should be aspiring to.
Wow.
This
is so interesting. You should have a blog about In Memoriam sections.
I am a big In Memoriam critics, and I think Kirk Douglas was the right person to end on, so they at least got that right. Yeah, but it is something that I am critical of, because I expect respect for the people who deserve it. Anyway,
my only other thing I wanted to mention was that this is my parent of young children bias, but I thought the Frozen song was really good. I liked the way they brought in all the Elsas of different cultures. That was another cool.
That was good.
Way to bring in the whole world of cinema. Also, her performance was better than last time she was at the Oscars.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was so much better than last time. Yeah, I mean, people have opinions about Idina Menzel live, but she did a great job. And then the nods to the mispronunciation of her name were funny.
Yeah. I was wondering, like, are they going to get John Travolta back and see if he can redeem himself? No, we're just going to make fun of it, which is better.
Yeah, I think that was better. I think he doesn't deserve the chance to spell, pronounce exactly as it's spelled, and then having all the different cultures worked in. Although there was no way that Elton John was, I mean, like, there's no way when Elton John's nominated, they're not going to give him the Oscar.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, there was something about the Elton John song that felt like a song I'd heard 50 million times, and yet I found out it was a new song, and I was like, wait, didn't happen in the 70s?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it wasn't a song that had already come out.
Yeah.
Hadn't already come out, yeah. Anyway, it was a good show. I always enjoy the Oscars. It's just like, if they want to increase the ratings, if they want people to get people talking about it more, they got to bring in an interesting host that people want to watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I get that.
I thought I was going to say Ellen has been my favorite from the last few years. I thought Chris Rock was pretty good a few years back, and then he was back for the intro of this, and I thought he was
with Steve Martin.
Yeah, which I thought was an interesting pairing. I feel like Steve Martin actually was not as funny as Chris Rock, which was a little surprising because I loved
Steve really Martin. Match.
Yeah, it was an interesting pairing. But yes.
But we need to figure out who the next Billy Crystal is, the next Bob Hope, you know, the person who does it a whole bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Because when you have somebody who does it a bunch of times like that, there was something about a Billy Crystal who is like inside the industry but still can make fun of it, and mm-hmm. and there's like a camaraderie and it feels more intimate. And go back and watch some of his stuff from the 90s, and it's just like, this is what the Oscars is supposed to feel like.
Yeah, I always remember just looking forward to the opening, because they would do a big opening, like, sketch, basically, with him.
Yeah, and that's gone.
It was so funny. Yeah, they just don't do that anymore. Yeah.
No, they had a fun thing with Janelle Monáe, but it's still... Yeah. But there wasn't the humor aspect feels... Yeah. The closest we got was when Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph... Oh, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And,
yeah, they were good.
And Ray Romano.
Will
they said they were known for our film work.
Yeah.
Or whatever they said. Yeah, so
and they like didn't know what a cinematographer was. That was so funny.
Yes. He knocks on our trailer door.
Bring us coffee. That's so funny. Yes.
All right.
Well, mixed Oscars. Happy about the winners. Some things not happy about with the ceremony itself.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just very critical though. So.
Yeah. And well, so are people. It has some of the lowest ratings ever. Is that right? Something like that.
It is the lowest rating ever. Which I mean, like part of that's also due to the fact that the ratings for everything are going down because TVs. People are dumping cable. I mean, they have to figure out a way to make this immediately available streaming, which I don't think they've done.
Yeah, like the Spirit Awards, which I watched, last year they were on YouTube, I think, and this year they were on Twitter. So it was like, it was really easy to just throw it on the TV.
I think part of the problem is that the Oscars have a very long-term deal with ABC.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's through like 2028 or something. Hmm. And ABC doesn't have... I mean, there's Disney Plus, but ABC doesn't have technically its own streaming platform.
Yeah.
So they would need to make a deal, but Disney has controlling interest in Hulu. They have Disney Plus. If they made the Oscars available on those platforms live streaming, I guarantee you the ratings, like the overall viewership. Yeah, people would watch that. So I don't know why that hasn't happened.
Make it happen, ABC. It will be a good thing for everyone.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, somewhat aside, did you watch or do you care about the Spirit Awards?
You know, I did. I read the winners, but I didn't actually watch them.
I tuned in a little bit, and just briefly, I was so happy the Farewell won things because it was my favorite movie last year, and it won
such a good
best film. It has won some awards, but it hasn't won anything really big, and so I was so happy. And then Nai won Best Supporting Actress too, and I was so happy about that.
Awkwafina never really picked up Best Actress theme for the Oscars, even though she was in the conversation. She never really, really became a serious contender.
Yeah, it's a fantastic performance from her. And that's actually now streaming on Amazon Prime. I'm trying to tell everyone, go watch The Farewell. It is such a good movie. And then one other thing about the Spirit Awards is look up Adam Sandler's acceptance speech for Uncut Gems, because it's very, very funny.
Another person who didn't make it to the, who was almost there but didn't make it.
Yeah.
Best Actor was a little competitive, I think, this year.
Yeah. Spirit Awards are fun because they are almost in the shadow of the Oscars a little bit. So if you don't know, the Spirit Awards are basically the indie film awards, and they like there's a cap on how much budget the movie can have. That's how it's like the lower budget movies. Things like Uncut Gems are nominated for lots of things, and Adam Sandler won for that. And he made a lot of jokes about the Oscars and how he was, you know, quote unquote snubbed, and he like makes a big joke about it. Anyway, Spirit Awards are pretty cool. Watch them next year, and I'll link to that Adam Sandler speech as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, watch independent films.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's another part of that. I mean, like, support indie cinema, mm-hmm. you know?
Branch out a little bit.
Which is awesome. Yeah. Branch out a little bit. Because there's a lot of... It's just amazing what it takes to be in the conversation. I'm glad something like the Spirit Awards exist.
Yeah,
because that's how people find out about these movies.
There you go. We're ending our Oscars discussion by recommending a different awards show. But there you go.
I mean, you know,
yeah,
that's good. Ultimately the reason that people wonder, like, yes, awards are ultimately subjective. And while you can definitely tell the difference often between a good movie and a great movie, when you have a bunch of good or great movies competing against each other, it comes down to personal preference so much of the time.
Yeah.
And ultimately the point that these awards serve, I mean, it ultimately comes down to the fact that we're still talking about It Happened One Night. Mm-hmm. And why are we still talking about It Happened One Night? Well, a lot of that is because it won this award nearly 90 years ago.
Yeah.
And because it won that award, it has managed to live on in the public consciousness when people look and see what has won this award before.
Yeah.
And they're what we get to do when we award a movie, something like the Oscar or something like the Independent Spirit Award, mm-hmm. is we get the chance to keep it in the conversation for decades upon decades to come.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I was thinking about that, like 100 years from now, Parasite will still be Best Picture winner 2019. And people will remember it for that. I think that's really great.
Yeah, and I don't think that, like, and that's some, you know, a movie like 1917 probably didn't need that to remain relevant. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Like, 1917, it will probably be on great war movies list.
Mm-hmm.
Or if people want to find out about World War One, it'll be on World War One list.
Watching it in high school in 20 years, yeah.
Yes, it's a movie that'll be shown in classrooms.
Yeah. Exactly.
But Parasite, just like La La Land a couple of years ago, is a movie when people are looking for escapist musicals, there's so few of them made that it will continue to be something people watch because we don't have that many options for musicals anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But Moonlight will not have that advantage and will be a tougher movie to get replay. And so it having that award keeps it relevant and keeps it discoverable for generations to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
There you go.
Well, there you go. I think that's a good place as any to end the Oscars talk. And thank you again, Rance, for being back. And next time we are going to discuss another all-time great, which is Casablanca.
If not the greatest.
If not
the greatest movie ever made.
Yeah. We'll wait and see if next time, if Rance thinks this is the best movie, what your opinion is. About the best.
I'll hold it too, close to the chest.
We'll tease that a little bit. All right. Well, thank you again, and we will call it quits from here. And we'll catch you next time.
That is all for this episode. Big thanks to Rance for joining us for this series. Be sure to tune in next time for a discussion of Casablanca. Maybe you've always wanted to watch Casablanca. This could be a great excuse to finally see it. If you like what you hear, rate and review the podcast, and you can follow Art House Garage on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Letterboxd, and email me, Andrew@arthousegarage.com, if you have comments or concerns. Till next time, keep it snob free.